Blog Talk Radio.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruption. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on the court from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Delicious Talk Radio, the segment bringing sexy back. I am your host, Gail Delicious Johnson. We're here every Wednesday. We're here every Wednesday at 9 p.m. for your listening pleasure. And tonight, we have a very special guest. And I'm not going to give my long intro because I really want to get into this show tonight with our very special guest. His name is Jimmy Lark, but he also is known as Jermaine. And he's from Philadelphia. At the tender age of 17, he was wrongly convicted of armed robbery and murder, a crime he protests his innocence. He was given 20 years max with a 20-year probation. After serving 4 years and 4 months, he escaped and was on the run for 10 years, where he made a lot of accomplishments along the way. Now, some prisoners that escape from jail, generally they get out and they do their repeat offenders, or they get out and, you know, just do crazy things, or they get out and get caught. Fortunately for Jermaine, he got out and he did a lot of things in that time that he was out. So what we're going to do, we're going to bring him on so he can give us a little insight on in those 10 years and how he got accused of the crime and, you know, what he's doing now with his life. So without further ado, I'm going to bring on Jimmy Lark, also known as Jermaine. Good evening, Jermaine. How are you, darling?
I'm doing good today. I'm doing good.
That's nice. Can you just let our listening audience know a little bit about your life before you was arrested at the age of 17?
Well, I was born and raised in Philadelphia. Mother and father, 20 sisters and brothers, 12 brothers, 8 sisters, all under one roof. We have a nice, good, clean background coming up. Went to school every day, church every Sunday, you know, obedient children. You know, I was an obedient child. Everything was good coming up, you know, from the age of, I guess, birth until 17, till this incident happened in my life.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're from a very large family, and was your father always in the household?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Well, that's good, because some, you know, may think that because the father wasn't around, these things may have happened. Okay, well, let's dive into the fact of when you turned 17, what had happened to cause your life to go in the direction that it went?
Okay. September 3rd, 1970, I was going to take my mother to take my grandmother to pay her bills. This is what I normally do every month. I was the driver of the family for my mother. My brothers had cars too, but I was the one to stay at home, always running errands and doing things. I was like the child under the apron, always with
mm-hmm.
my mother. And it paid off, because a lot of my goodness comes from that incident,
right.
That experience. You know, so on that day, September 3rd, I was going to take my mother to pay the bills for my grandmother. And I heard a shot, and I ran to the corner, and I looked, and it was somebody laying down on the ground. Someone just got shot. But when
mm-hmm.
I went to the corner, mind you now, when I come out of my house, I go get my car, and I park in front of the door so my mother could come out and get in. My mother had bad days. She couldn't walk. So my car was 2 cars from the corner. When I heard the shot, I went over to the incident, and there I seen a guy laying on the ground. It was a white guy in the black neighborhood, and he was shot.
Mm-hmm.
That was the changing experience of my life right there. Me going to
mm-hmm.
the scene to look to see what happened, because there's other people out there, witnesses and stuff, and the person who done it was my brother. He gave himself up and told him I had nothing to do with it. You know,
mm-hmm.
that was the day my life changed.
Wow. So how long was it after the incident that your brother gave himself up, and what made him give himself up? Because they had you locked up, or was his conscious, or did your mom talk him into surrendering, or what happened?
All of the above. I was arrested later on that day, because I took my mother to pay her bills, as we normally do, and when I got back, the police was all out in front of the house, all down the street, everywhere. Police was everywhere. And I got
mm-hmm.
out the car. I said, something happened. They come here to get me, because they was coming out the house. So I got
mm-hmm.
out the car, they took me in there, and the police said, well, we want to take him down for questioning. He's supposed to be a part of a robbery just happened. So
mm-hmm.
they took me down, they arrested me, they questioned me, they beat me. They did
mm-hmm.
everything under the book. Yes, they beat me, the old-fashioned stuff with the phone book. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
That ain't no
joke.
Oh,
my goodness.
Yes, yes. Listen, all the time I maintained that I had nothing to do with no murder. I wasn't involved no way whatsoever. They already knew who did it, because the witnesses knew my family. They was the neighborhood kids. We was kids, and they said it was my brother. But by me coming to the corner and going to see what happened, the witnesses thought I was a part of it. That's how I got
mm.
implicated. So now I'm arrested at the police station. My mom and everybody upset, so they talked to my brother, made him say, okay, I'll go down there and tell the truth that he did it himself, and I wasn't involved. All the time between now, the time I got arrested, and to the time he got down there, they got like 8 different statements from me. All I'm saying, I had nothing to do with it. But by
mm-hmm.
me being 17, young, first time ever been in the police station, first time ever been in trouble, they coerced me, they beat me, and they told me, if I signed this piece of paper saying that I was a lookout, that they let me go home, because all he wanted was my brother.
Mm.
And they told me that my sister is coming down here to take me home. As they told me that, my sister came walking past the door where they had me handcuffed at the room. They had her
mm-hmm.
walk past the door with a bag that had a gun in it. And they told me that she come down here to get you, to take you home, but you just got to sign this. and that's how I got committed.
So, in other words, they beat you, then they coerced you to sign a paper. Let the listener audience know what that paper was that you had signed.
That paper was a written statement. They didn't do it by, take quarterly statement. They did it by written statement. They was going along telling me what to say. They write it down. They tell me what to say. Repeat it. They write it down. Tell me, repeat it. It's a written statement that they put together. It's like it was a puzzle. They put this puzzle, the statement together, and then told me to sign it. And that was a statement saying that I was played part into this robbery murder.
So that's...
You didn't think that do happen. You see it on TV a lot, but it actually happened with me. It is 100% true.
Well, I know that policemen coerce people, and you know, there are a lot of... coercions going on to make people confess to crimes that they've never done just so the police can get brownie points or whatever. And
exactly.
True, you do see this on TV shows, different TV shows. You see where the police plant things on people and then they beat them. And, you know, so it has to almost, you know, when you sit down and you think about it, it has to come from somewhere. If they display this stuff on television, there is some truth in it, you know.
Right.
Because I know of a few people who were, you know, beat up by the police as well and lied on about the police. So now after you did that confession and your sister came down, your sister came down with?
My sister came down and bought the gun that my brother did the shooting with. He had turned himself in. He brought the gun. They came off down, the family came down to say that I had nothing to do with it. My brother came down to say, I did it, and the sister said, here's the gun. She was not charging anything. She was just coming down with him as support for him to turn himself in. She came down to give the gun to the police and to say that this is all, you know, could be redeemed real quick. My brother here saying that he did it, and this brother here had nothing to do with it. So it should have been squashed right there. But this is the exact words that the police use. Quote, this is ain't nothing but another dumb black lock. We're going to get him now before he turn out to be crooked and criminal.
Mm. Wow.
So in other words, they're saying he don't have no record, but we got him there and we could charge him with something that he had nothing to do with, but we got him now by his name, his family, we can convict him, we could keep him. And that's what happened.
So, I mean, I know you were very frightened, you know, especially being accused, number one, of something that you know you were innocent of, and then the fact that they beat you. Did your mother and father ever come on the scene?
Well, my mother came down there with my brother to turn himself in. They came there. My family was down there strong. You know, they know that that's nothing like anything I would have anything to do with. They know. And my mother knows, too, because I was with her that morning. I was going to take her somewhere. I just walked out the house to go get the car. That's funny how time could be. Like, in other words, like, you know, I'm very spiritual, and I say, like, God put people in certain places for certain reasons. And I'm saying, why did he have to put me there at that time to see that and be a part of that? That really, it puzzled me for many, many years, but now I know. See, what I'm doing here tonight is from what happened that day. And the things that I'd done while I was out, to accomplish, it was done all from this. So God put me there for that moment to do what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So now you're accused of this crime. You go to court. Now, I know back in 1970 they didn't have the forensic, things that they had like DNA and all those kind of things to really say that his blood is there or this and that is there. So when you went to court, how did they do the conviction, and how did they make it stick? And your jury, were they all white? Were they mixed? Or, you know, what played a part in your conviction?
Well, number one, I didn't have a jury. I took a judge.
Okay.
Yeah, back then they used to call it
a judge. Was that suggested to you by your lawyer to take a judge, or you just decided that on your own?
The lawyer. Well, let me tell you, I wasn't criminally minded no way whatsoever. So I'm going strictly by my attorney. And my attorney, I hate to say it, but he sold me out.
Yeah, was he white?
He's black.
Oh, okay. Well, they do it too sometimes.
Yes. It don't make no, it, nowadays it don't make no difference about the color, but he's a black guy.
That is true.
I thought he was truly representing me. But things I would tell him to say, he wouldn't say it. He said, no, not now. Wait, I know, I'm going to get to that. And he never got to it. And I felt then, even then, I knew that I was being sold out. Because, I'll speak to this later, but I made a statement to the judge about me being convicted for something I didn't do. And I told him that I was not going to serve the time. I'm not going to do this time because I didn't do the crime. So even then, at the court hearing, you know, I had one judge. I had Judge James T. McDermott, which I think he's passed away now, deceased. And there were some witnesses from around the area would see me go to the corner at the time, after the shooting, with them. Like, just like they went and looked at the body, I went and looked at the body. I went to see what happened. I'm standing when the police came. You know, if the witnesses wanted to say he was there, he was a part of it, because everybody said no, they didn't see, they'd have seen somebody running. Now, the witnesses said they seen me come up to the corner. They didn't say that I participated. It was the police that engaged them, because I even seen some of the witnesses after I was arrested, because I never made it back home that day until I escaped. I didn't see my home or my family no more. Well, I seen them at the prison, but I didn't see the streets of my house no more until I escaped. But they never did say that I was a part of it. It's that they seen me come to the corner, which I seen them, and we all was right there with the police at the time. That played a part in me being convicted.
Okay. So now you're in jail, and I'm quite sure you're very distraught, disappointed, and were you angry? I'm quite sure anger did play a part in it, but because of your Christian background, you was also seeking some type of spiritual relief, I'm sure. Now, when did you plan your escape?
Well, as I said, I mean, it just might sound, it sounds far-fetched, but for someone like me or people that know me, it's not too far-fetched because I'm low-key, but I'm determined. From the day that the judge sentenced me in that courtroom, because I thought I was going home, the judge said to me, I'm going to do you a favor. So right then and there, oh, God, I'm going home. Thank God. He said, I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to give you 8 to 20 for the murder, and I'm giving you 20 years probation for the robbery. He said, I could have done worse. He said, I could have gave you worse, but I'm going to do you a favor. That hurt my heart. And right then and there, I told the judge, I will not do this time because I didn't do the crime. I didn't commit no crime. I'm not going to do this time. So I didn't plan it right then and there, but I made up my mind that I wasn't going to do that time right there.
So let me ask you this. Were you in a maximum security prison or?
I was at Great Forks State Penitentiary. That's a maximum security prison. Yes.
Now, can you talk about how you escaped from the prison?
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about it. I can't say everything because.
Right.
But I'll give you enough details to understand and see where I'm coming from. But let me say this here. You asked me earlier about when did I plan it and how did I do it. Well, let me get back to the part about when I planned it. Well, I come from a big family now, and I had two brothers and a nephew up at the prison also when I went there. And I was the youngest inmate there at Graysford Prison. I went up there at the age of 18. I was the youngest in the prison. They kept me isolated on an isolated block. Then they put me out after, like, I think it was 3 months or 90 days, something like that. I was in quarantine. Then they put me out. So I got with my brother and them, and I'm starting to see how jail life is. And I said then, this is not for me. This is not for me. And that day on, when they would be out playing pinochle and dominoes and whatever, I'm in my cell writing in the book about how to get out.
Okay.
I planned that. I wrote down every day. They would say, I never learned pinochle. I never learned dominoes. That's all they did every day. I always think to myself, I was always writing. I wrote many different ways to try to get out of the prison, many different ways. And I showed some with my friends and family. You know, they said, don't do it. You're going to get killed trying. It's not worth it. But it was worth it to me because I was in jail during time for something I had nothing to do. I wanted to be a lawyer when I grew up. Was finishing school. I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to be a judge. I had some hard sights about what I was going to do with my life. But me coming here at 17 and being charged with something, that just crushed everything. So I didn't know what to do, but I knew I didn't want to be in prison.
So you actually wrote down a number of plans to escape.
Yes. I had a book. I called it the Book of Escape. I was trying, I worked out, I had a job in the main quarter of the prison. It's about four blocks long, too. I mean, you barely could see to that end. And my job every morning was to clean that quarter. I mean, we go down to the front gate and mop all the way back every morning, three times a day. That was my job. And by me being out there, I was seeing how the guards come in. I was seeing what time they come in. I was seeing what they do with their clothes, where they go at the chain. So I knew just about the background of all the stuff that goes on inside the prison as far as coming in and going out. So I had formed many opinions about several ways of getting out of the prison because I was out there every day for 3 years. For 3 years, I worked that job. And I knew it, and I was trustworthy. You know, guards respected me. They know, some of the guards even knew. They say, we know you didn't have nothing to do with that crime because we could tell the difference between you and your brothers. They knew.
Right.
They didn't know nothing about me, but they knew the difference between me and my brothers. I wasn't into drinking no alcohol, no pills or nothing. I wasn't doing none of that. All I wanted to do is get my business and wait to come home. That's all I wanted. So anyway, I wrote the book. I wrote plans on how to get out. And after, and it was just another thing. It was so many gang fights. I mean, it was not South Philly against North Philly. It was Muslim against the non-Muslim. And these are fights that take place where people get killed, actually get killed or beat halfway to death. I was involved in a lot of this stuff because my brother was involved. And I'm right there on the front line. It was an incident that happened in the yard where it was like 400 people on one side and 400 on the other side. It was Muslim against non-Muslim. Muslim against South Philly, and it got so bad that people, one person had a gun, a derringer, two-shot derringer, and everybody else got swords, knives, pipes, anything you could name to use as a weapon. And I got caught up into that almost at least once a month, lockdown, the prison fight. I couldn't live like that no more, so I had to plan a way to get out.
So when you escaped, you went alone or did someone go with you?
I went by myself. Everybody told me I wasn't going to make it. But I knew I had faith in God, and I had faith. I was feeling things. You know, it wasn't like I was writing this myself. It's like my hand was being guided. I was feeling things. But you know what? I could have did this here years before, a couple years before, but I couldn't because you know why? My mother. This is how much I care and have faith and really, you know, respect my mother. I would not do that until she gave me permission to. And every day, every time something happened, we get locked down. My brother and them get in fights, the gang wars. I would tell her, I got to get out of here because I'm going to wind up killing somebody or getting killed. Because my brother and them right up there on the front line. Now, I can't, you know, turn my back on my brothers, my blood brothers I'm talking about. I can't turn my back on them. So I'm right up there with them. I'm protecting them while they're trying to protect me. It is something. Which is you in the dark, you're going to either fight or you go now. And that's the way it was. And I wasn't about that, and I was tired of it. So this is what really prompted me to speed up this escape and really ask for permission to leave.
Wow. So once you escaped,
you asked me did I go by myself. Yes, I left the prison by myself. I came out by myself, but I had someone to help me, and I'm gonna put them out on the air.
Right, that's what I was gonna ask next. Who helped you once you got out? Who you know came to your aid to help you escape?
All right, this is the way it went down. The day before I escaped, I got a visit. It was January the 2nd. I got a visit day after New Year's, 1975. I got a big family visit. My brother was up there with me, too, and my cousin's nephew. So we had a large amount of people coming to visit. And my father, my mother, and my girlfriend, my son, everybody came up. I talked to my mother now. I pleaded with her with tears coming out of my eyes in the visiting room. My brother, I'm getting kind of touchy thinking about this because this brings back some feelings that I had put under the cover for many, many years. Anyway.
Right, I understand.
I talked to my mother. And I pleaded with her with tears in my eyes that, please, give me your permission to leave here. I know I can make it. I know I can do it. Just give me your permission. Give me your blessing. I got to get out of here. And she cried. My father cried. And he finally said, if that's what he wants, let him do it. And she said, okay. And she cried. She said, if that's what you want to do and you know you can do it, then you have my blessing. Right then and there, I talked to my father on the side for a few minutes. And I set it up. I already had it planned up, written up. All he had to do was follow my instructions. And he followed my instructions that next morning. And I was out there at 7 o'clock in the morning. I was leaving the prison ground with my father.
Wow. Wow. So
is this when you escaped?
Yes. I escaped that morning, that next morning from my visit. When my mother gave me permission and her blessing, I escaped that next morning. I was tired, I was fed up, and I was ready. I wouldn't do it until I talked to her, until she gave me her blessing, because that's the type of child I am. She gave me her blessing.
So if your
God
mother had said no, because she would have been fearful.
I would have stayed. No matter how long it took, I would not have did it.
Jimmy, that's my co-host, Jade, that was asking us questions. Good evening, Jade, darling.
Hi. I was sorry. I'm just tongue-tied. I'm amazed at this story. Wow.
Yeah, because it was truly amazing.
Sorry that
you know, you see
that.
The stories on television. I almost escaped, almost this, almost that. He escaped, and let our listening audience know how long you had been out.
Well, I stayed out for 10 years on the run. Right here in South Philadelphia. Right in, and listen, I would go to
so
see my mother.
You didn't leave. You didn't.
Go ahead.
You didn't leave the state that you were originally at.
No. Well, I took a trip for 3 months and came back. And that trip was to go use and make me a new name. So that's when I discovered, that's when I invented a new name within 3 months. But after that, 3 months, I had made plans because my mother wanted me to turn myself in. And like I said, I listened to what my mother said no matter what. So where I was at in Boston, I did decide to come back to Philly to turn myself in.
Was this after the 10 years or?
No. That was 3 months after I escaped. I came back to Philly, but I didn't turn myself in because I couldn't. It was too hard. I had started back to school. I had a job at the I was working at the airport at Philadelphia International Airport. I was doing good. I mean, it was just too hard to. I really love my mom and respect her wishes, but she also finally agreed to that. Okay, if you don't want to go back, okay, we'll stay, but do something with yourself. I went to school, but I did come back to turn myself in. That was 3 months after I escaped. But then I changed my mind. I said, it's time for me to strive higher and to do something to prove that I don't have nothing to do with any type of crime like that. And that's when my life of rebuilding really took off.
So you didn't, the police never checked back with your family to see if you were there or they weren't looking for you, didn't have posters up or anything like that for you?
Yes, they came looking for me quite often. They would run in my house. They would beat people up. They would lock people up. I mean, in several cases, my sister's husband was there. He got beat up, I think, twice. They were coming to my house like maybe 2 times a month over the whole 10 years. And listen, they told my mother, we know he's around. Tell him to give himself up or we're going to shoot him on sight. We're not going to ask him no questions. We're going to kill him. We're going to shoot him on sight because he's a convicted killer that's out on the run for escape. We don't have to ask him nothing. We're going to shoot him down like a dead dog. That's what they told my mother.
And that's why she begged you to come? Is that why she begged you to turn yourself in?
Yes, yes.
Wow. Well, that's enough because if the police was telling me they were going to kill my son, I would ask him to go back too, you know, and she basically was looking out for your welfare. But you just had the confidence and was following your spiritual self and doing this quest of doing other things because you know you were innocent of that crime.
Right. Listen to this. When she, at the time when I came back, when she said, okay, if you're not going back to jail, do something with yourself. After I finished school, I got my GED from Boston. I came back to Philly with my GED. I went on to apply for cooking school. I went to OIC for chef school. I went to JFK for auto mechanics. Now, I didn't complete the chef school. I completed my auto mechanics. I got a certificate. Then after that, I wanted to go any higher. I went and took my SAT, which I scored pretty high on it, and I went to Temple University. I majored in psychology, child psychology.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Jimmy, a.k.a. Jermaine, who at the tender age of 17 was arrested and convicted of a crime that he knew that he did not commit. So we'll be back shortly. Well, I thought we were going to take a break. Well, we're not going to take a break right now because my switchboard, let's see what's going on here.
Well, if you got time, I got something else I wanted to say.
Oh, well, go right ahead because right now we can't take a break anyway because
okay.
I have something going on with the switchboard. Go on, dear.
Okay, you was telling
me. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Let me also let you guys know that my co-host Jade is on the line, and that's who was asking those other questions. Jade. Good evening,
hello,
darling.
Hello.
Okay, so go
good
on,
day.
Dear.
Say that again. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying hello, Jay.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Okay. Listen, y'all said something about was there any posters on it? Yeah, it was posters out about me when they was coming to the house looking for me. I was spotted 3 times during the course of the 10 years. I was spotted. I was involved in one at one particular time I know about, and it was witnesses to clarify it. I was spotted at 30th and Lehigh in North Philly, two blocks from my sister's house. Undercover cops, they seen me. They was black. They was in plain clothes. And I knew they was cops because of the way they was riding around looking at the time. So I had my aunt's car and my baby sister with me. And as I went in the store, I seen them look at me, and they stopped, and they backed up. They backed up through traffic. And I seen it, so I came out and I got in the car, and I seen them point. While they was backing up, they got caught in traffic. So that was this is what you would call one of your TV chase scenes, you know, the police chasing. Anyway, I got in the car and I sped off. They was trying to catch me, chasing me. I went from 30th and Lehigh to 33rd and Powelton in about about 3 minutes. You know, like seemed like every light was green. God was leading me away from that. And I managed to get away. But at that time, they announced over the radio, the police radio, that Jimmy Locke has been spotted. He was in such and such area in a such and such car. Now, another friend of my brother was in the police car handcuffed at the time. He heard the whole thing, and he called my mother and them and told them what was going on. Then he just heard it over the radio. So that was one time I was spotted, and they gave me a chase. You know, I gave them a chase, and I got away. There was another 2 times I was spotted or something came up. I'm not too familiar with that because I'm only going by hearsay, but this is something that happened that I know that had got out to my family members because it was told at the time that it was happening. You know, right after it happened, they let him out the car. He went and told my family the police are chasing your son. So they had posters. And when I was at Temple University, this is the part that this sent chills through my body, too, remembering this. I came out of one of my school buildings. I think it was my recreation building. I had on my Temple University clothes and whatnot. And I had a car. I had a driver's license and everything. I was legit. But I had tickets. I was back then they called it scout law. I had parking tickets. No speeding, just parking. So I got in my car, pulled off, went around the corner. The police pulled right behind me and stopped me. They told me, I showed them all they could say I was wanted for a scout law ticket. So they locked me up. This is Temple University that brought in Montgomery. And the police station is at 17 Montgomery, 2 blocks. They took me to the police station. They put me in there. They had me handcuffed. You know, as they bring you in, they line you up. I mean, I was shocked to see I'm standing right beside my wanted poster. Standing right beside it. Right beside it. I looked. I was shaking in my boots. One officer said, "What you here for?" And the dude said, "He here for ticket, scout law." He said, "Man, you don't have to be worried about scout law. Like, you don't have to be shaking like that. He don't know all the time that he's talking to Jimmy Locke." I'm scared to death. I got my books with me. I say I got to study because this is really important. I got to study for this test. So they uncuffed me and they took me and put me in a cell by myself. Said, go ahead and take your books and study. But all the time, I wasn't worried about that. I was scared to death that they were going to recognize that they had me, because they said they were going to kill me when they catch me. I mean, I thought they was going to beat me to death down there. And then there was a guy in there, that a friend of the family, he knew about me being on the run. I used to take these guys running and training with me. I told him how to run cross distance. That's what I did. So he said, Jimmy, they finally got you, huh? And I'm telling, oh, my God, be quiet, man. They don't know who I am. I mean, that little bit right there, that was just imagine. Put yourself in them shoes, in my shoes. Put yourself in.
Those banalist tapes that you got.
Wow. Tell me about it. I'm telling you, this thing is God-gifted. That's what I like to call the whole book, God-gifted.
So let me ask you.
Go ahead.
Did you say something, Jade?
I think that was him that was still talking.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
I was going to say that they did let me out. I had some money on me. I had to pay $35 to get out. So I paid my I had $30. I got the files from the guy who was calling my name. He gave it to me, so I paid my $35 and got out. But that's the day that I stopped going to Temple University. I never went back since then. And I was there for two semesters. I was so afraid. I gave up my career. I gave up my scholarship. I gave up schooling. That scared me to death, and I thought they might figure out that they had me, and they let me go, and they would come back to the school and get me. So that's the day I stopped going to Temple University, the very next day.
Wow. Well, you know, now you did some other things when you were on the run as well. Can you give us a little input on different things that you did?
Well, I did a few things. One main thing that I live for and I thank God for and I give him all the glory and praise for it, about the two kids within the house, a burning house. One night in 1979, January, I was on my way to a friend's house, and it was like 1 o'clock in the morning. I'm riding my bike, and it was cold, really, really cold. It was single digits degree because I wasn't supposed to be out there riding my bike. And it's somewhere up by 57th and Chester or somewhere, Springfield, somewhere up in there. It was a house on fire. It was a corner house. And I rolled up, seen all the smoke. I hear people screaming. So I pulled up to the house. And then I hear kids screaming inside the house. And I see that the mother, she's in the gown. She's trying to run back in there to get the kids. But the police holding her, say she can't go back in. It's too much fire, too much smoke. There's black smoke coming out. The kids is upstairs somewhere. I pulled up on my bike, and at that moment, when I seen the mother and then the police, then I blacked out. But what took place at that moment, God guided me back into that, well, not back, God guided me into that house, up the steps, to the front room and to the middle room. He got both of them kids and brought them back down the steps and brought them out to the parents. And that time, I don't remember, all I remember is hearing the voices, hearing the screaming, the black smoke, and then coming back out getting air because I started choking myself. The kids were choking. I was choking. I got back on my bike, and I took off. All that time, the people were saying the mysterious man did this here when he saved the kids and disappeared. All the time, that was me. At my trial some 10 years later, that mother came there. She recognized me through the paper articles. She came to court and said, that's the guy who saved my kids.
This was 10
and
years later.
6 years later, because it happened in 79. She came to court in 85.
Okay,
six
so what were
later.
You in court for at that particular time?
Excuse me?
What were you in court for that particular time?
Oh, okay. I'm jumping way ahead of time. 3 months after I escaped, I was granted a new trial. I got my new trial under prosecutor misconduct, which means the prosecutors, the DA, they labeled me with something that shouldn't have been said. They said that I was cunning, baffling, and evil. They used the word describing me at my trial. So that's illegal because, first of all, they didn't know me. Secondly, I never even been arrested. I had no kind of police contact whatsoever in the 17 years of my life. So how can I be honest? How can they label me like that? And I'm saying I didn't even commit this crime. So how can they label? That was false. That put a bad impression upon the audience, upon the judge, and whatever. Cunning, baffling, and wicked. Conniving.
Wow.
Everything They delayed me. So they gave me a new trial 3 months after I escaped. I was granted it. Now, that's another reason why my mother wanted me to come back, because I had this new trial. She said, you go back now. The court see that they done wrong. Yeah, they gave me a new trial because the DA said something wrong. That don't mean that you will still think that or believe that I'm innocent. They just saying he made me wrong. So I still had to prove who I was and what I'm about. That's not over with yet. So from that time on, the 3 months after I escaped, I went to build upward instead of just staying level. I had to prove myself. That's when college came in, the training class, the chef school, the auto mechanics, going to working at the Y. I had 75 kids under my instruction, 75 kids at the Y on board of master. And even the director at my Kingman trial said, what kind of guy was he? Said, I'll usually be late sometimes getting there, but I'm there, I'm good for the kids, and the kids respected me. That's the type of person I am. These are the things that I do. I mean, daily, even now, like if we was at the zoo with my granddaughter. I'm taking care of looking after my grandkids when my daughter go to work. This is my father, mm-hmm. taking to school, go pick them up. You know, if she got to work or go out somewhere, I watch the kids. That's my job. That's what I am now. And I took them to the zoo. I went to the zoo with the school, and the kid fell in the pond of water. You know, just like the grandparents was there with the child, but see, like nobody, everything was in slow motion. I managed to rush over there and grab the child. The child went underwater. I even went, not all the way, but from my waist down or my chest down went underwater. Grabbed the child by the arm, brought the child out. And it seemed like everything was moving so slow with everybody else, but I had the speed. And I wasn't even near, at least I didn't think I was near, but I was able to get to the child before the child completely went under. You know, and it just takes me out. And I be keep saying, God has put me in these places for a reason. And that's what I think about my life. I don't think that I'm living it for me. I think I'm living it for God. I'm here for people, just like this case, what I'm doing now, talking to, it's people that's in my situation that I might can help. You don't have to come out from prison and commit crime because they sent you to prison. Even if you didn't do the crime to go to prison, don't come out and do another crime. Don't let prison make you bad. Prison's supposed to be about rehabilitation. You rehabilitate yourself while you're there, because the prison's not going to do it. Some prisons do.
They're
I'm not
going
to knock them. Yeah, but you have to do it. You have to do a lot of this footwork yourself. It's all on the individual. And that's what the life that I lived that proved that the way they labeled me was wrong, the way they convicted me was wrong, and I came out and proved myself. I'm not perfect. I mean, I had some downfalls. I'll talk about it later on, but I have not been back to prison. I have not committed a crime.
Wow. Now, in those 10 years, how did you get exonerated? Or are you exonerated? After, you've been on the run for 10 years, you did this, you accomplished that. How did you get exonerated, or are you exonerated?
Okay, after the 10 years, when they caught me and took me back to the prison, they had to give me my new trial. They had a certain time. It's called, I think it's 180 or something like that. You had to bring you up to court within a certain amount of days, 6 months. So as time was getting close, so we were just trying to work out a deal. They didn't want to try me over again. The system knew all that I had accomplished, all that I had done. They knew they was wrong. They knew they made a mistake. So they said, this guy ain't going to show us up. So this is what he do. Let's give him a deal. The time that he had, let's cut it. They offered me 3 deals. One was to take from the 20 years, take 7.5 to 15. I said no. Take 5 to 15. I said no. So now this, I want to come home. I want to establish a life out here on the street. I had a family. I want to come home. And me being impatient like I did when I signed a statement, want to come home sometimes could be the worst thing for you, not always the best. So by me wanting to come home, they came down. I said, let me go home, and we could have a deal right here. So they said, okay, what we're going to do, you get 4 years and 4 months before you escape. You got 6 months in now. So you got 10 months in now. So you ready, you have 5 years altogether. We're going to give you a deal from 4.5 to 20. How do you like that? I said, as long as I can go home, I signed it, because I already established myself on the street. I'm not worried about what the law say or what the court say about me. I established myself. I don't worry about that. But come to haunt me, you know, this stuff come to haunt me, like whenever you go for a job now, it always comes up, and I don't lost many jobs behind. My police record came up. But anyway, That's how I got exonerated. We worked out a deal for time served. I had Judge Lisa Lachette, which is a very, very understanding judge, and I thank God for her. She worked out a deal with me. She said, look, I'll give you 4.5 to 20. Don't worry about the probation, just 4.5 to 20, and all you have to do is sign it and plead guilty. So I signed the deal, and I pleaded guilty for the 4.5 to 20, which was time served, which made me immediately eligible for parole.
So
that's how I got
after all that, they still made you plead guilty to
yes,
a crime
yes.
that you did not commit.
Yes. And even then, if you read the newspaper articles that from the Daily News Archive, it is say, even then that I'm pleading guilty, I still acknowledge that I am innocent of the crime. I'm doing this to get home to my family. I don't care about what's going on in the background. Let me go home to my family. I'll work it out with them. I'll make it. I'll be okay. Just let me out of prison. So I was caught in 1985. I served 10 months to get all this stuff worked out, time served, a deal, and to make parole. It took me 10 months to get this done. I fought. I struggled. I mean, I had people working with me from community college, from the public.
Mm-hmm.
It was people really fighting for me because the parole people did not want to let me out because I committed a crime in jail, which is escape. You don't come out when you escape. You're supposed to do some time in jail, in the hole for that. And I did. They did send me to 18 months in the hole, but ain't no way in the world I could have did no 18 months in the hole. I never even been in the hole before. So they're going to bring me straight off the street. They're going to bring me straight off the street after 10 years and going to tell me I got to go in the hole for 18 months. That's crazy. So anyway, I told him, that's another thing I said, I am not going to do no 18 months in the hole. In some ways, when I put my mind up and I say I'm not going to do it, I ain't going to do it. God will make a way. So anyway, what happened with that, I don't want to jump too fast. I ran into the warden who was a sergeant at the time when I escaped, but when I came back, he was the warden, superintendent. And I ran into him in the hallway when I had a visit. They gave me a visit behind glass because I was, you know, in the hole. I did do 3 weeks in the hole. But I seen him that day, and I talked to him. I said, man, you got to get me out of here. You know I'm not about this kind of stuff. I've never been in a hole before. He got me out the same day. The same day. They blocked the population. Yeah,
well,
so
you know.
Go ahead.
Through your spirituality and, you know, holding on to your faith, I could say that God did work in your favor. And because you did not give up, all these things, you know, happened for you that were contrary to how you was painted out to be a robber and a murderer. And
right.
I'll tell anybody, you know, there is a God, and as long as you have faith and trust and believe, he will deliver you.
Yes.
You know, you may go through some trials and tribulations, but that's part of the test, to see where your faith is, and by you keeping your faith and your trust in God was why you was delivered. And so now, and you also talked about when you go to try to get jobs that there's a tarnish there. Now, I myself had been locked up in Kentucky. Well, I started out being locked up in Alderson and transferred from Alderson to Morgantown, and Kentucky was when I got released. And they tell you to how to fill out applications and this and that. But you know what? When I got out of jail, I said to myself, I'm not going to even put that on an application. Because, number one, if they don't know, they won't know. And just so happened, my crime was possession with intent to distribute cocaine. And, you know, to work in a hospital, they would never let you work in a hospital when you're, you know, have uncontrolled substance drugs, because you're working around drugs. You know, I worked in a lab where they had liquid cocaine and, you know, different drugs. So I said to myself, and they say to tell them that if they ask you, you've been convicted of a crime, to put that down there, and you'll talk about it at the interview. You're not going to get an interview. So
right.
I said to myself, and I prayed about it, and fortunately I got the job that, you know, I had went, when I got out of jail, I went to school, became a certified phlebotomist technician and did that for over 20 years. But nowadays, they're drug screening people, they're checking their records, and it's a whole lot of things that they're doing now that they wasn't doing back then, you know, because that was
right.
like in the late 80s. But
right.
I just feel if a person has faith and trust things will look up, things will get better, and things will be better for you, but you have to have that faith. You have to have that trust. And anybody out there in the listening audience that has a question or a comment, hit the one that will raise your hand and I will bring you in. And if you're listening and need the call-in number is 646-652-2877. Again, the call-in number is 646-652-2877. And call in and speak with our very interesting guest this evening. And I'm quite sure you listening audience out there, you heard something, that you learned something, you know, or you may have a question you'd like to ask Jimmy as far as, like, you know, how he's doing now, which we are going to get into that. But I'm going to see if we can take a break again. But if not, we're going to get right back to the show, okay?
You're listening to Bringing Sexy Back right here on Delicious Talk Radio. There is no religion or politics spoken here, only delicious adult conversation. Audience participation is encouraged, so log in and create an account to engage in conversation in our chat room. Feel free to call in with your questions and comments at 646-652-2877. That's 646-652-2877. And let's get this delicious talk conversation going.
Listen up, I got to tell you about this beautiful author and publisher, Gail Delicious Johnson. Gail Delicious Johnson is proud to announce the publication of her new revised issue of her latest suspenseful novel, Back to Zero. Read this riveting story of intrigue, conflict, love, and suspense. Follow the trail of abuse, secrets, lies, and love. And check it out. You can't just read the back of the book, because you have to prepare yourself for the mind-blowing, explosive ending. Order your personally autographed copy of Back to Zero by visiting www.jjpublishing.com. That's www.jayjaypublishing.com. Back to Zero is a fictional story with a dash of reality. It's a tale about Anthony Thomas, a man who lost the most precious things in his life, starting with his first childhood love, Gloria. Tragedy soon followed after losing his mom to cancer, and shortly thereafter, he lost his wife, Lynn, and son, Junior, in a horrific car crash. With each traumatic incident, Anthony was branded, sending him back to zero. 30 years later, Anthony runs into Gloria, and the flames in their hearts are still burning. Gloria, now a law enforcement official who also comes with baggage, a psychotic husband named Wayne Anderson who is out of control. He, too, is a law enforcement official that's abusive, jealous, and an alcoholic. Wayne treats Gloria miserable. While snooping behind his wife, he finds out that she had research information concerning Anthony on the internet. Wayne goes into a rage of madness like a rabid dog because in his sick, twisted mind, he feels threatened and accuses Gloria of sleeping with Anthony. Often, he would evict her from the house, but not realizing the night would come when he forces his wife straight into the arms of Anthony. After spending an intense, earth-shattering night of lovemaking, Gloria opens up and confesses to Anthony that she still loves him. Rekindling their relationship is dangerous, and Wayne will stop at nothing to make his wife and her first love's life a miserable hell while fighting his own demons. Wayne harbors a deep, dark, and deadly secret, one he thought he and only the devil knew. Find out what happens when Gloria uncovers the truth about her abusive, lawless husband's mysterious past. The devastation will bring the three of them together in an explosive confrontation. Find out the shocking secrets Wayne harbored and prepare yourself for who will pay the ultimate price for his lawless actions. Gail Delicious Johnson says, Back to Zero will take you where the law becomes the abuser. Order this fast-paced, action-packed field drama by best-selling author Gail Delicious Johnson from her web store at JJ Publishing. That's J-A-Y-J-A-Y Publishing.com. Remember, abuse is never an option.
All righty, welcome back. That was Dee Dee Sharp, Ain't in Love. Okay, this evening's show, we have a very special guest, Jimmy Lark, also known as Jermaine, who was convicted at the age of 17 of a crime that he did not commit with determination and spiritually bound. He escaped and has been on escape for 10, and had been on escape for 10 years, and he did some amazing accomplishments along the way. And we're about to wrap the show up, but I still have a few more questions that I would like to ask Jermaine before we close out the show. Jermaine, now you mentioned that you have a large family, 20 siblings in all, and one and your brother who committed the crime, whatever happened to him?
Well, that was my brother, Nathaniel. He died in prison. He's received a life sentence, and he died in prison. I think it was 23 years he died in prison of cancer.
Oh, wow. So they finally convicted him. But during the time when you were, when did he get convicted? How did they finally accept the fact that he had did it?
Well, with the witnesses and the fact that he admitted that he did it and gave up the gun, you know, it was a it was a cut and shut case. You know, it was done deal. It was obvious. You know, he committed it and he admitted to it. See, they took his admission as far as it was pertaining to him doing the crime. But when he told them that I had nothing to do with it, they didn't want to accept that part. So that's what got all this stuff going on. You know, they accepted his verdict, his plea that guilty and he committed the crime. They didn't accept the plea that the verdict when he was saying that I had nothing to do with it.
Oh, okay. All right, now I understand. So they didn't want to really let you go because of the simple fact. You know, it's always some type of a loophole for them to do whatever it is they do, because when they find out that someone else had did the crime, sometimes they still will hold the other person that was accused of the crime, you know. And I think that's very unjust, you know, even though the justice system is a joke at times, because for some people they can cry innocent and be innocent, and they don't hear them, you know.
Right.
So, like I said, with your guidance and your trust and your faith and your belief in God got you through that.
Let me say this, Gail. I know guys that was in my position also. By me being in there, I consider myself being right down in the gutter with all the low lives and the people that they throw in it that really committed stuff. And I also was in there with guys that was like me, innocent of the crime, might have been standing around or knew about it or whatever, or just didn't have nothing, didn't know about it, period, but were convicted. I know these type of guys. And one thing I want to say to the guys, the people that's listening, either on the street or behind the bars, if you have faith and if you believe in your heart, not just out of your mouth, but if you believe within your heart and you have the faith and you stand some strong morals and principles, you can overcome that. You can beat that.
Yep.
You will get help. Look, God help those who help themselves. If you believe in yourself and believe in him, you will not lose. I kept my faith, I kept my belief, and I kept my morals. Now, one time did I use drugs inside the prison, alcohol, nothing. I did nothing wrong still. And when I was, oh, it's just so much I had to say that I could say to people out there to give them the insight of how to go from bad to right, or how to go from right to right. Even if you're right, you still have to believe in yourself. I know guys that was innocent, got out of prison, and started doing wrong because of the life they lived inside the prison. That wasn't going to go for me. Go ahead.
You went 10 years before you were proven innocent, right?
Right, right.
I guess my question to you would be, what would be the suggestion that you would give to our listeners who may, and not just necessarily prison, but just go through a struggle that's so hard for them that over time, because my thing is 10 years, I would have eventually given up. Like, I really commend you after a few years or so, knowing my innocence, and things still are not working out for me. And it, you know, a few years turned into 5 years. I think that I would have given up and just given up on life altogether. So, you know, I commend you, but what would be your advice for people who may be in your circumstances now? Because there are people who are innocent who are in jail, or for those
right.
that are just struggling in life altogether, and so that
right.
they're never going to get out of that.
Right. See, one thing I want to say, well, it's a lot of things I want to say, but like I just said, the main thing right before you asked me to say it, I'm getting chills because this is getting really spiritual. But when you believe in your heart, when you know in your heart and you're willing to sacrifice, see, the thing is about sacrifice, what you're willing
right.
to sacrifice for what you believe. And that's, I think, is the key for me. I don't know about other people, but that key right there, I was willing to sacrifice my life. I believed in God before then. I asked God then, and I believe in God now. I was willing to sacrifice my life to stand up for what I believe in. See, when you get to that point, God's not going to turn his back on you. If you say, well, Lord, I'm going to lay my life down for you to prove who I am, he's going to help you. I don't care what the situation is. I know. I've been there. I've done that. I know for a fact. I don't talk and did it many times. When the post chased me that day, I said, God, please just get me out of this here. I'll do another good duty. Please. And, you know, I was sincere. I might laugh about it now because I look back on it funny. But I was sincere. And I get chills because it's spiritual. I mean, one thing you have to do is believe. You have to believe deep within your heart. And you have to be willing
right.
to sacrifice for that. That's the main key. You know you're innocent, you got to believe it. You got to be willing to sacrifice for it. I ain't talking about going out there trying to escape. I don't want nobody to try to escape because that wasn't easy. That was definitely God. I was guided by God out the prison. I don't want nobody to do that. I'm saying believe in yourself. Strive to do good. Do things that other, you know what, I was volunteering to go out and shovel snow when I had a bad back up at the prison. When the snowstorm came, I volunteered to go out and say, oh, that was Locke again. He'll get it. He'll go do it. I did stuff like that because I did stuff to make them, to show them that I'm not a bad person. I'm not going to say, oh, these white folks going to have me like a slave. No, I got to walk their wall. I got to walk their hallway. I got to do stuff like that. These other old folks got to get out there and walk it. So, yeah, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to bend my back for y'all because that's the type of person I am. You do good. Anything, anywhere you at, there's always room to do good and improve yourself. And before you know it, it accumulates and things will grow up for you. It will get bigger for you. So one thing I'm saying to people, keep the faith and do good. It's never going to turn its back on you. You're always going to win at the long run.
Wow. All right.
Yes.
Go ahead, Ms. Delicious. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say that, you know, I can't really say it enough, you know, like he had just mentioned, if you believe in your heart, it definitely has to come from your heart that, you know, because you can move mountains, swim
Absolutely.
The deep oceans, and do things that you actually thought were impossible. But as long as you believe in your heart and you had that faith and trust in God, with God, nothing is impossible.
That's right.
You know, because when you said, like, when you told the judge that you wasn't going to serve that time, you know, that was coming from your heart. And
right.
when you got in there and you started writing about your escape, God was had that pencil in your hand. You know, so I would tell anybody, never give up, never give in.
Absolutely.
And as long as you have it in your heart, you can do anything. And I can test for that. I was a crackhead. I was a junkie. I was a lot of things in my life. And I just turned it all over to God and trust and believe. I have not looked back since. And that's been over 30 years ago. So if somebody say, well, I can't stop smoking, I can't stop doing this, that's because you don't want to stop.
Right.
You have to stop. And you have to have this in your heart. And God is not going to take you anywhere and leave you. But if you don't have
right.
it in your heart, get it, you know, and I commend
yep.
you as well, Jermaine, because, like, when you got out, you didn't go around committing crimes, killing people, trying to get transportation, robbing people, and, you know, going from city to city, leaving a destructive tail. You know, you got out and you progressed. You did things that was progressive, like a regular citizen would do. And I commend you for that, you know, because all escapees are not good escapees.
Right.
Not.
I think I really, you know, overachieved when I was out on the run. Matter of fact, I think my life was better on the run as Jermaine Glover than it is now, because I get so much repercussion because of my name, because of that case. You know, it really hinders me, but I don't stop fighting. I still go out and get jobs. They turn me loose. They cut me loose after they find out about the murder conviction. They let me go then, but I will go out and get jobs. I will work. I will
even
go out
though
and do
they
stuff
know,
for me.
Even though your innocence has been proven.
Well, they say they got to go by what's down on my criminal record. When they pull it up, it say this here in the conviction. That's what they go by.
It wouldn't be expunged or anything under the circumstances that you were innocent and you, in fact, were not the...
Once
a
felon, you're always
a
felon. You know, I'm still a felon.
Yeah. The key is about getting it expunged, and this is where the Commonwealth didn't want to lose. This is why they were so much willing to a person that escaped, stayed out 10 years, convicted of murder and robbery, and we're going to take him back and let him free in 10 months. The key to that game was if we get him to sign this deal, he can go home, but they're still saying he's guilty. So we didn't lose. We can let him go on the street. He might go out there and commit another crime, but we need to keep that conviction. So if he willing to sign us here, let him go home. Let him go home. But we still got him down as a criminal. That's the game they play, and that's how they got me. As long as I sign that thing to go home, just like it did to get me there, that's what it did to get me out of there. But it still haunts me all the way till today.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they play.
I have two quick questions.
Yes.
I don't know, and I don't know if Miss Delicious asked it earlier, but did you ever forgive your brother?
Yes, day one. When he came
down
here.
Did you know it was him? Did you
know
he was the one?
Yes, I seen him running. Yes.
And then my next question was going to be, what was your brother's it doesn't have to be personalized, but what was your brother's conversation like to you about the situation, knowing that you were convicted for something that he knew you didn't do, and in fact that he did it? Did he ever during the time that you were in there confess that it was him, and then he apologized that you were the one that was in there, or he just wasn't trying to give himself up? How did that work out in the conversation that took place, if there was one?
He cried many a night. We was up there together. And there's something I did want to touch on, too, also. He cried many a night and said, I tried. I mean, my family know. They went to court. They came down to the police station with him. They know that he came in there. They brought him down there to turn this up in to tell him that I didn't have nothing to do with it. So this was on from day one at the time of the arrest. So he didn't have to say too much, but he cried many a night about, Jermaine, you shouldn't be here, or Jimmy, you shouldn't be here because of what I've done. I mean, I tried to do everything. I told him that he didn't have nothing to do with it, but he's saying that's how these folks are. They want to get you. You being convicted by your name, not by your statute. And he cried many nights, and he felt really, really bad about that. He never really got over it. It haunted him until he died in prison. And let me tell you, when I was planning to escape and I was writing the book, tell me, no, you ain't going to go out. He was older than me. No, you ain't going to go like that. You're going to go with me. I'm going to make sure you be all right. I'm going to take you out of here. I caused you to get in here. I'm being the one to cause you to get out. He had planned to escape, too. It was quite a few. Matter of fact, back in that time, a lot of people was planning to escape. But wasn't too many of them being successful. But anyway, he had planned to escape, too. And the way they was going, I said, nope, I'm not about that. That's not going to work. I ain't into that. I was more sophisticated. So right after I escaped, they told me I was going to get killed. Right after I escaped, 2 weeks later, he tried, and they got caught. It was three of them. And they got caught. They didn't even make it out the prison wall. You know, they was trying in the trash truck, which was stupid, very stupid. You know, it's trying to crush you up. You know, but I don't want to get too much into detail, but eventually, 2 weeks after I escaped, he tried, and he didn't make it.
So
they've been hard. Okay. He cried many nights to say he was sorry that it happened and that he did everything he can do. Even at court when he's been sentenced, he said, I had nothing to do with it. But that's the way they are. The system, when they want you, they'll hold you. They'll find something.
Yeah.
They'll trick you. They'll con you into doing stuff. They'll put yourself there. And I'm a witness. I'm a true witness because I lived it. I walked it. They would change. Like you hear the people that's confessing the crimes now, you would do all that and then go right and confess. I don't believe some of it because I know how they can hook you up. They could cross you up and they have you believe me did it before you leave out of there. I'm telling you, that's the way the system is.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then I was going to also say, as far as you being exonerated or myself, you know, God forgave us when it happened.
Right.
But, man, he will hold things over your head forever.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So I'm not even concerned about it because they say you couldn't vote if you was a felon. Whoop-de-doo. I never voted.
Right.
I voted once in my life when I was 19, and I was forced then. But I've never voted, so that wasn't a privilege that I felt I lost. Really, I didn't feel I lost any privilege, not unless I couldn't get a job. And like I said, I refused to tell what I put on the application that I was a felon. So, you know, I just had that faith as well as yourself. And it moves mountains.
Yes.
You know,
absolutely.
Right. So we'll always be felons. You know, we always have that on our record, you know, but I don't even, it doesn't bother me because if I want a job or whatever, and I see where it says, were you convicted of a crime? No.
You
even
know,
though
I really,
was, I did, I was.
Go ahead.
I was guilty, but it was my first offense as well. And, you know, things went totally wrong for me because the first time I ever got in trouble was with that. And I didn't know the judicial system. I didn't know anything. I had wrote a letter to the judge confessing, and my lawyer told me I should never have done that, but I didn't think. I just thought if I told him, you know, he would be lenient, which he was, but I'm not saying it's because I wrote the letter. But my lawyer was saying I was going to go in and plead not guilty, and he could have gotten me off. But by me writing a letter to the judge and the DA, prosecuting attorney, she was on this high crime case, and she was out for blood from any and everybody. So that's how I got convicted. But, you know, there are things that I learned along the way. I would never tell you, never write a letter to a judge. And if they put you on a thing because I also was using drugs, they tell you to stay clean. I didn't stay clean. You know, I was just doing everything opposite. So that's why I got convicted. So there are things that, you know, you have to listen to and you have to go with regardless to what people are influencing you or telling you to do. Do what's in your heart. You know, and if I had just followed my heart, I probably would not have served time, but I would have been put on probation, which I was put on probation for, you know, the rest of my stay. But, you know, nowadays, if someone had did what I did nowadays, they're going to lock you up for a long, long time.
Yes.
You know, back in the 80s, it wasn't like it is now, because if you get caught with a couple of rocks or whatever, they're going to give you 10 years. You know, I was caught with drugs, a gun, and a box of ammunition. So, you know, things worked out well for me, but I'm still a felon. And I'm not even going to, you know, I don't even address that when I go look for jobs or whatever, but I really don't have to look for a job at this particular time in my life because I'm retired. But when I got out, the first thing I did, I went to school, got the highest grades in my class, and we took the four-hour exam and applied for the job, and it was on from there. And I was, you know, certified for the phlebotomist technician for 20-plus years, you know. So,
you know, I want to say this to the listening audience also about, you know, guys that's coming home from jail. Because I see so many people come out and repeat the same thing, repeat offenders.
Yes.
You know,
you
don't have to do that. You look, when you go to jail, would you see them telling you what time to get up, what time to go to bed, when to wash, when to eat, and when to go to work? That should teach you, look, you're not being a man. You have to come out here and set your own boundaries. You have to find a job. You have to go back to school. You have to strive for something. You want to go higher and higher and higher, as high as you can go. Now, right now with me, I'm 63 years old. I'm, like, trying to lay back. I'm still healthy. You know, I'm doing good. I'm looking good for my age. Everybody tell me. So I'm, like, lived my life already. Now I'm here about trying to keep the kids right, my grandkids right, my daughter. My daughter had a birthday. Happy birthday, Jamia. Today is her birthday. She's 25. She's here with me. And
birthday
her kids.
To your daughter.
That's my life. Yeah. Yeah, Jamia, happy birthday. Yeah, that's my life now. And them guys, when you come out, don't go back to crime, because you know you're going back to jail or you're going to die. There's no other answer. There's no other answer. Either going back to jail or dying. There's no other answer. So if you want to live, you want something out of life, you go get your job. You go find your woman. You get some kids. You raise. You do what's right. Know what I learned? The easiest thing in life is to stay out of jail. You know how you stay out of jail? By not doing nothing wrong.
Yeah, that's the truth.
By not doing nothing wrong. Some people get convicted of stuff, but mainly, for it, you don't do nothing wrong, you don't go to jail. That's it. It's simple. Don't do nothing wrong, don't go to jail. I got a baby brother that never been to jail, a few brothers that never been to jail, never been down police station. I say, why are they different from, you know, the other people? They don't do nothing wrong. You don't do nothing wrong, don't go to jail. Go out there and get your job and go to work. Get your woman, get a family, y'all build stuff, live until you die. That's the key. Key to life,
yep.
Key to wonder.
Yep. So let me ask you this, Jimmy. If you had this to do all over again, would you do it the exact same way, or would it be something different that you, how you would handle it?
I would do it the exact same way. I wouldn't change nothing. Let me tell you, I've been through life. I've seen a lot. I mean,
mm-hmm.
4 years in prison, then when they took me back, I've seen a lot. I don't know if I should say this on the air, but I've seen one guy get raped by 17 guys back to back to back to back.
Oh, my goodness.
I've seen stabbings. I've seen killings. I've seen a lot just in prison. I've seen a lot
mm-hmm.
on the street with my family members in the black mafia, the crime, the drugs. My brother died of OD. My father, who came and got me from prison, shot dead in our doorway while he stood in the doorway, shot in the chest and fell back in on our living room floor and died in front of the children. I've seen a lot.
Your dad?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
4 years after I escaped, he was shot and killed. And I'm standing in the doorway. I dropped my shoe.
I'm sorry to hear that. Wow.
Yes.
Mm.
And so, you know, life don't have to be like this. I've seen a lot. I wouldn't change nothing. Because everything that I've done, I can see it and I can explain it, I understand it, and I know why. And everything, the top of the letter is God. See, I understand God today and how he worked. I understand why he did with me what he did. I wouldn't change nothing, because even today, you know the story about footprints in the sand?
Yeah.
Well, that's where I'm at. I understand that God's been with me all the time. When I look down and see only one set of footsteps, footprints instead of two steps, that's when God is carrying me. He's carrying me.
Yep.
See, I understand all that now. See, I didn't understand it before. So with the way my life is now, I don't have much, but I got enough.
Yeah.
I don't have much, but I got enough. And that's because of God. He's been there. He's going to be there. And see, like I said, if you believe, he'll show up for you. But you have to believe within your heart.
Put
your life on the line. The answer to your question, no, I wouldn't change nothing. I'd try to make things better. But I wouldn't change nothing.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. How would you, are you a mentor or anything like that at this particular time?
Yes, basically to family, but I have a job coming up sometime later on where I can be a mentor. I worked at the Y with kids. When I was living in Lebanon, the judge said after 3 years, he'll recommend me to work back at the Y with this new children's program, youth program that they're going to be opening up. And that's due in 2016. I'll be eligible for that. So I'm not doing it now, but that's what I live for. I live for to give what I got to others so they can get the rewards that I get from life.
Well, how would you tell any young man who, let's just say a young man who's not a troublesome child, but maybe he wanted to go around the corner and see who got shot. How would you direct that child if, you know, you saw him running around there? What would you say to that child?
Stop, look, and turn around. Stop, look, and turn around. Because what it did to me, it changed my life. I mean, I don't know what I would have been if I would have not went around that corner. But where I'm at today, I could see where I could tell someone else, stop, look, and turn around and go back. You don't need to know. You don't need to know. It's not, read about it in the papers, see it on the news. You don't need to know, because sometimes it could put you in the wrong spot. Sometimes it could put you at the scene of the crime, especially with today's stuff. Stop, look, and go back.
Right, right. Okay, so I think I have one last question. Now, you're in a place where you're happy with your family. When you was locked up, did you get a lot of family support?
Yes. I got a visit every week.
Okay.
Every week for the time I was arrested, I got a visit either from my direct family, my mother, father, and brother and them, or my girlfriend I had who was pregnant at the time. She got pregnant, 4 months pregnant when I was arrested. So I had a visit. That's something that was very, very important to me, staying, you know, stable and level-minded, not getting what you would call institutionalized. I kept my mind outside the prison walls by writing how to get out and by writing my family or my girlfriend. Every day, my brother used to say, all you do is write. Don't you get tired of that? Come on out the cell. Nope. I don't want to be a part of it. I'm in here writing. Getting ready for a visit. I'm writing my girl. I'm writing how to get out of here. Every day. Every day for 4 years.
Wow. Well, that's very impressive, Jimmy. And I'm so proud of, you know, how you conducted yourself before the crime, during the crime, while you were incarcerated, when you got out. Because, you know, some of the guys that actually do crimes, they go to jail and they serve time instead of going to jail and letting time serve you. So I do commend you for all that you've done and, you know, what you're getting ready to do in 2016. You know, I'm quite sure that some young men or men are going to learn a lot from you. And if you just save one soul, you know, at least you've done your part. So,
that's my
purpose. Right.
You hear me?
What did you say?
I said that's my one purpose on earth. On earth is to make a change in somebody's life.
Well, you definitely will.
Yes.
You definitely will. And I have so many callers that are not raising your hands. If you have a question or comment, now is the time to ask it. You hit the one, and I'll see your hand come up, and I'll bring you in because we are getting close to shutting the show down. Jay, do you have any closing comments or questions for Jimmy?
The show was, you know, it was disheartening to hear, but at the same time, it was uplifting, if that makes sense. You know,
it does.
Yeah, so I hate that happened to the brother, and, you know, and blessings to you in all your future endeavors and everything. You know, you deserve it, because we can't, certainly, you know, you can't never give back that time. You can't get that life back that was taken from you. But I just want to say blessings to you. And this is a very touching story. Very touching.
Yes, yes. Jimmy, do you have any closing remarks?
Yeah, I got one. I got a few things I want to say real quick.
Let me know
if I'll be talking too much, because I do get off like that sometimes. But I
just
I just want to say that I have a lot of things to say to put out to people that I think can make a difference in somebody's life. I don't know how to go about doing it. I'm seeking out help for, like you said, with this book and possibly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, at one time, HBO was interested in my story. After I was captured, they came up to visit me in the prison. They brought me some money. And they was trying to work out some kind of deal for a movie. But I was getting so much publicity from inside the prison, they stopped them from coming. And so they really stopped them from coming up there. So this thing here is big. It's big. A lot of things haven't been said, you know, or touched on that can really be beneficial. So I'm trying to get a book done. I want to get help to get this book done and possibly even a movie deal or sell the rights to a movie. So that's my two goals right now. Now, with you, I'm trying to get this book published or whatever, get it started, and possibly the last thing I want to do is try to get some kind of thing done on film. For it could go nationwide. People need to see this and hear this. I'm quite sure that someone, quite a few, could get something from this to help them turn around because, you know, if you don't see nothing, you don't know nothing. You have to
see
it. You have to see it to understand. And I know this can make a difference. And when the judge told me that I could do something to help other kids and that he's going to back me up with that in 2016, that really meant something to me. So I just don't want to go do it by faith. I want to do it by book and by film. So if anybody out there that knows some people got some contacts, look me up, get with Gail, and help me get this thing started.
All right. Okay, now that's Jimmy Lark, a.k.a. Jermaine. And I want to say to my listening audience, we've come to the end of another fabulous show. And we're going to give our special guests a great big round of applause.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you, Jimmy, for being my special guest this evening. And also like to thank my co-host, Jade. Jade, let's let everybody know how they can get in touch with you.
They can get in touch with me, with us, every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's on Erotic Talk Radio, and they can check us out, blogtalkradio.com/Erotic Talk Radio. We even have a group page on Facebook, Erotic Talk Radio, so you can also ask to join that group. And I have a full online boutique, eroticexpression.net, for enhanced people's romance. So, yeah, thank you.
Right. Okay, Jimmy, is there any way that people can get in touch with you by email, or is there any way that you'd like people to get in touch with you?
Well, you can contact me. My email is Jimmy Lark. Hold on for a minute. My daughter just did it for me. It's a new one. JimmyLark@gmail.com.
And spell your name for them, your first name, because it's spelled different than the
J-I-M-M-Y. It's J-I-M-M-I-E. My last name is Lark, L-A-R-K. You can also get in touch with me through my phone number also. My phone number is 267. Can you hear me?
Yes, mm-hmm. I can hear you.
Okay. Hold on. 267-584. 3302. That's the phone number.
Okay. All right. So we do appreciate, our listening audience for participating in tonight's show by listening. And like I said, all you guys that are on the line, we appreciate you for at least calling in and listening. And as you know, I'm Gail Delicious Johnson, the host of Delicious Talk Radio. I'm an author, ghostwriter, publisher, poet, and soon to be a storyteller right here on Blog Talk Radio, meaning I'm going to be reading my very first published book, chapter by chapter. I don't know, how long it's going to be or anything like, but that probably won't start until November. And you also can visit my website at JJ Publishing. That's J-A-Y Publishing, where you can get autographed copies of any of my books. And my number one bestseller, Back to Zero, you have got to get that book. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook at Gail Delicious Johnson. And I have a fan page on Facebook, which is JJ Publishing. Or you can Google. You can just Google Gail Delicious Johnson. And also, every Thursday, I co-host over there with Jade on Erotic Talk Radio at 9 p.m. So if you're up to it, tune in at Erotic Talk Radio or Blog Talk Radio tomorrow at 9 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, drive, don't drink. And if you drink, don't drive. I love talking to you guys, not about you. And never look down on a man unless you're helping him up. Spread love and give love. Love you guys. Have a wonderful weekend and good night. Thank you.
Gail?
Good night, everybody.
Gail?
Thank you for your support.
Yes, Jimmy?
Oh, I wanted to make a correction real quick. The phone number you can contact me by is 215-584-6881. That's my new number. 215-584-6881. Yes.
Okay. All right, then.
All right.
Did you guys get that? That's 215-584-6881. And that's how you get in touch with Jimmy Lark, a.k.a. Jermaine. Everybody have a wonderful weekend. And, again, love you guys. Good night. Thank you.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to my Nana's Internet Radio Show because it's the best. Good night.
You heard it. See, I put the plug out by the book of the film, a movie.